the Strident is Inside Motorsport.
And good evening once again for another edition of Inside Motorsport. This week, Craig Revell taking the week off. He's been working too hard, so it's just myself, Colin Ford, and on the other side of the panel, Peter Norton. Good evening to you, Peter.
Good evening, Colin. What a wonderful day today to get out and do some time in the garden and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's if you don't suffer from hay fever like I do.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. That's not to say that motorsport is over for the year. There's still plenty going on, and plenty to talk about tonight.
Well, that's right. There's heaps of motorsport still going on. Of course, today, Simmons Plains, last round of the BAC Gases Australian Super Touring Championship. We've got Paul Morris from there. Hopefully, get hold of a couple other bodies there as the evening goes on. One of those stories down in Tasmania, trying to get hold of people on mobile phones. The mobile phone system down there isn't really the greatest. And, of course, we've got a few other things that are on the go around the traps. We've got news of things that are happening, of course, in Formula One testing, British Touring Car Championship, Kart, interesting announcement during the week about the new head of Kart, which we'll talk about a little bit later on, and all sorts of things. You know, it never stops, does it?
That's right. Even when the on-track action slows down, there's still lots of testing and other developments, and of course the silly season, people moving around.
That's true. Well, today, as we mentioned, down at Simmons Plains, they held the latest round, round six of this BAC Gases Australian Super Touring Championship, and the winner down there today was the man himself, the dude, Paul Morris, and we were fortunate enough to get hold of Paul a little bit earlier on. This is what he had to say about his wins today. Simmons Plains, Paul Morris, two pole positions and two wins. You must be pretty happy.
Yeah, it all went to plan. Yeah, I'm stoked.
Yep. Now, this is basically tied up the BAC Gases Super Touring Car Championship for you, so next couple of races you're there to try and improve on the record, as they say.
Yeah, well, now we've got the championship, we'll refocus the goals and see if we can go through undefeated. It'll probably be a tall order, but we'll give it a shot.
You'd have to really be sort of wondering who's going to have to come out of the woodwork to try and beat you.
Yeah, it's sort of, obviously we've got a pretty good car and probably one of the best teams out there, so it's not all me, but if the other guys get their act together, there's no reason why they can't.
Yeah, you've had some fairly close tussles in the past with Peter Hills and John Henderson. How are those guys going against you today?
Yeah, they were right there, and then it was very close, and tyre wear was a big factor, and those guys just made some silly mistakes, which sort of was the difference. So it's really the consistency in the driving, which is making the difference, I think.
Mm. Yeah, today as well, your team, they put in an extra drive in the form of Owen Kelly. How did young Owen go?
He performed tremendously, got second in both races, and had a good battle with him in both races, and I'm absolutely wrapped in his performance, and he's coming to the championship and showing the other guys how it should be done.
Yeah, of course he's hoping to hopefully do the final couple of races of the championship if he can find suitable sponsorship.
Yeah, well, his efforts today won't do that any harm, and he's done a great job for his sponsors, and I'm pretty sure they will be behind him.
That's good. Of course, Owen, no doubt this is a bit of a thank you for what he's trying to do for you during the year in terms of the V8 testing and so on.
Yeah, we've been running Owen in the V8 supercar, and right from where go, he was a good driver, and he doesn't make any mistakes, which is pretty hard to find in someone of his age, and he brought the car home today and without a mark on it, and looked after it and drove it as hard as he could, so we're very pleased.
Now for you, you've got a bit of a gap now between now and the next race, which is at Wakefield Park in the Australia Long Weekend. What are your plans over the Christmas New Year break?
Just going to kick back and probably head up to Hamilton Island for a week or so and hang around up there and sort of get back the first week of January and get prepared for the coming season.
Sort of a major job there because you are once again running the two championships.
Yeah, look, there's a bit of work to do, but we've got it all mapped out and where we need to go. So try and give the guys a couple of weeks off and then straight back into it.
So, of course, recharge the batteries, ready for another season.
Yeah.
Well, Paul, congratulations on your two wins again today and on taking up the championship.
Okay,
we hope you have a good Christmas and New Year, and we'll probably catch up with you at Wakefield Park for the first round of 2001.
That'd be good, and thanks for all your support throughout the season. It's been great.
No worries, Paul, and thank you for your assistance as well.
Thanks.
Yeah, Paul Morris, we've hung around his pits a number of times, particularly at Bathurst, came in quite handy, because where he was sort of in the middle of all the leading teams, and just in the right angle to look up the back of the pit lane there and look at the big big screen TV to see what was happening out on track. Very handy location.
And, of course, his team caused a lot of the action that was happening out on the track.
Jeez, people won't let that go away, will they? Actually, very interesting to hear, to read in the British motorsport magazines and newspapers their views on running at Bathurst. Quite an interesting sort of different slant to it, you know, because of how they're used to running things in Europe and how they run it here and the like. But, yeah, quite interesting, the difference here. But actually, the one thing that is quite apparent from the British motorsport people who came out here, that's drivers and the press, despite the rain, despite the mud, despite everything, they all did enjoy themselves and they all want to come back again. And good on them. I'm sure we'll be happy to see them again next year.
Yeah, that's right. Despite all of those problems, it really was an entertaining race. And yeah, it's great. It was good to see the international press and other people taking more interest in it.
Mm. Now, of course, this week, the front cover of particularly our friendly magazine, Motorsport News, it won't go away, will it? Brock, Lowndes, you know, the connection, it just keeps on bouncing back.
That's right. Craig Lowndes, when he joined the Holden Racing team, Peter Brock was the mentor there, and obviously there's a lot of respect. Peter Brock was part of Lowndes' decision to move on. So it'll be interesting whether they can put something together there. Of course, the additional ingredient to that recipe is Ron Harrop, who has a lot of the facilities and the technical know-how to put a competitive team together. Because starting from scratch, it's a big task, but with Harrop in the formula, it could actually be quite doable. Brock brings a lot of corporate connections, and Lowndes is pretty good there anyway. Mm. So that's one that's probably got some merit.
Yeah. The interesting thing is that a lot of people have been saying for a while that, you know, that in terms of the Brock Lowndes connection, it actually brings a lot of things with Brock to Lowndes. One of them is the fact that apparently there's been little whispers going around that Mobil isn't 100% happy with the level of exposure they're currently getting on the Holden Racing Team cars for the money they're putting in. And Brock is being used quite heavily by Mobil for advertising overseas, interestingly enough. At the same time, Brock has got very good ties with Bridgestone, who, of course, are the controlled tyre supplier, so I'm sure he could probably find some bigger Bridgestone stickers to put on a car. And, of course, just the Brock name and Lowndes as a name combined. Brock in management, Harrop doing engineering, Lowndes doing the driving. What more could you ask for if you were a potential sponsor?
Well, that's right. And one area that Lowndes has matured and does a fine job these days is, of course, the PR side of things. Often amazed at the time he spends with the fans at a race meeting. No request for an autograph is too much bother for him. So yeah, he's really trying to really make himself a man of the people. And good on him, because that's really what it needs and what it takes to be a long-term player in this game.
Mm. And I think, really, you know, we've still got rumours flying around about the Prancing Horse issue, and this is another interesting one that came up during the week, was the announcement that Prancing Horse Racing would be not running one of the Panos cars at the Adelaide Race of 1,000 Years. Panos have now taken over the running of that car. They'll provide their own pit crew and people where Prancing Horse were going to assist. Jason Bright has stepped in. Again, another opportunity for an Australian to get good international exposure. And the word that Prancing Horse has apparently signed John Sidney to build some Ford engines for them. So, you know, there's some options going there as well.
That's right. Would they have to change their name, though? The name really does bring up the images of Ferrari and the Italian style. I suppose it would be all right on a V8 supercar.
Well, you know, Ford did produce the Mustang, which is another great Prancing Horse.
Of course. What a perfect idea.
Yeah, people aren't running Mustangs in the championship. I think Dick did that some years ago. But anyhow, it's going to be interesting because, again, the talk is that they pulled out of the Adelaide Race of 1,000 Years because they're bringing their commitments forward, which they had planned for, say, 2002 in getting into V8 supercar, into 2001. So that is proving interesting to see how that's all working out.
You mentioned Jason Bright as stepping into one of the seats there. Also, the rumours won't go away that he could be penciled in for the empty seat at HRT. Now, of course, Jason Bright has his sights firmly set on the USA and getting a full-time drive-in kart. What a fallback position, though. If you can't get the deal overseas, you just step into the hottest seat in Australian motorsport.
Mm. And this is the thing, that it is probably one of the hottest seats. I'm sure there's other people that they're looking at and have potentially got lined up for that. And, of course, the other word this week regarding Cameron McLean, who currently runs his own team, also potentially running for that FTR seat. What
Yeah, I think that is an excellent choice if that's the way they end up going. He's shown a lot of promise, but of course running your own team with limited resources makes it quite difficult to put together a competitive run week in, week out. So seeing him into a factory-supported team would make things quite interesting and really give him the opportunity to show off the quality that he's got. He's had a few opportunities, of course, mainly with the Shell racing team and Dick Johnson at Bathurst. He's a regular co-driver for that race, and he always puts in a tradesman-like performance. No doubt that is how Ford Tickford Racing have stumbled across him, perhaps. They've seen the consistent runs that he puts in there. So it would be great to see him with a more competitive drive, perhaps. The question, though, of course, is that Glenn Seaton's team has not got a great track record of putting a competitive second car on the grid. Okay, pole position at Bathurst, but we saw what happened at the first pit stop. The clutch had already had enough. Good luck. Hopefully it will be a step up for Cameron McLean, and he can make better things of it, and hopefully that second car in Ford Tickford Racing can win a few more races in the years to come.
Yep, and of course the other one that is being rumoured around the place, of course, is Garth Tander. You know, that he potentially is on HRT's shopping list, but of course he believes his best position is to stay with Gary Rogers Motorsport, because as he said, the team and he have been growing and developing together, and basically the team works around Jason Barguana, Bargs, and Garth Tander, and therefore why move to another team where, that, despite the fact you should be equal number one with somebody, if the other guy has been there for a number of years and has brought mechanics and people from other teams across, it could potentially leave you out in the cold.
Yeah, that could be quite interesting. We were speaking a minute ago about small teams and limited resources. One that does not seem to be suffering from that seems to be Paul Wheel with the TJ Thermal racing team and the Falcon that they run. They keep recruiting staff from some of the other large high profile teams, and the latest ones were the team manager and a PR lady who've been poached perhaps from the Shell and Dick Johnson Racing. So yeah, maybe that's a team to look out for in the future, particularly getting that know-how from the team manager, Dean Orr, or known as Curl. He's known as someone who knows what he's doing, so that could be a step up for Paul Wheel.
That's right. Curl has been one of the integral parts of Dick Johnson Racing Team, and that knowledge that comes, you know, all that expertise from all those years, and I think before that he was with Larry Perkins as well, so he's been holding with Perkins, Dick Johnson Racing, Ford Falcon, now with Wheel. I'd say this is probably the sign that Wheel is preparing to step up a grade. As I say, they're looking at a second car, second driver. They're not saying who at this stage, but they're suggesting more likely another young up-and-coming driver rather than one of the older, more established drivers who's around. So it'll be interesting to see who ends up in that second seat with that team.
Yeah, that's right. And a team that seems to have no shortage of drivers penciled in for next year is the Stone Brothers Racing. We saw in one of the magazines this week Tony Longhurst with his regular column, and he's a bit confused because he still believes that he has a contract for next year. The stories of his retirement may be a little premature, at least from his point of view, so we'll have to watch that one with interest as well.
Yeah, it's Marcus Ambrose, of course, has signed with Stone Brothers, and unfortunately we haven't been able to get hold of him. It's one of those cases. We have the numbers, we have the technology. If they don't answer the other end, we're in trouble. As I've just gone through a list of about half a dozen people here, and all I've got is their answering machines. It's delightful, isn't it? They're all out probably partying, enjoying the getting ready for Christmas and the like, but that's what happens.
That is a good idea.
Yeah. Okay, look, we'll just put the music on and we'll come back later. But no worries. Yes, it's one of those things that, you know, you've got Marcus Ambrose has been signed. You've got Craig Baird, bye-bye Baird, he's off now. He's obviously looking for a drive somewhere. I'd say very likely he may step back into something over in New Zealand. He's been also trying for Trans Am in the USA and New Zealand. We've got David Bernard, who's now replacing Craig Baird. So we've got a lot of new young guys coming in with some of these top-line teams. We've got Russell, who's staying with Larry at this stage. Apparently, you know, the checkbook hasn't been waived that can get him away from Larry. I think he's probably enjoying where he is there. I think he likes the style of that team. Larry, how much longer before he decides it's time to hang up the helmet? He'll be the next big one to go, as they say. I'd say potentially we might hear something early next season about Larry's future.
Well, Kestrel Racing, really, that's a perfect teaming. that Russell shoots his mouth off, upsets the stewards, or an on-track infringement upsets the stewards, and Larry steps in the stewards' room, and Larry, well, we know he's an excellent engineer, self-taught, I believe, in some respects.
And also a self-taught lawyer.
Absolutely. He manages to get out of all of the problems. He must have a silver tongue or something. He really is on top of Cairns and the stewards and all of the hearings. He knows the rule book backwards, and you need someone like that behind Russell Little.
Mm. Now, during the previous week, we had here a number of young drivers, including a young driver by the name of Alan Gurr, who's come out of karts, has been making quite a name for himself in the BAC Gasser Super Touring Championship, driving a Ford Mondeo for the Peter Hills team. He, this weekend, was jumping ship, as one might say. He was going over to Tony Newman's Peugeot 406 for the Simmons Plains round of the BAC Gasser Championship. Unfortunately for him, they had an engine let go in a big way during the first qualifying session. That was all she wrote, packed it up, go home. But as it was, Craig was able to catch up with young Alan Gurr the other week at the AIS training camp they had for the young drivers, and this is what he had to say.
We've been driving Ford Mondeo since round one until now, and we've got Simmons Plains coming up next round in 2 weeks, and there has been a change in which car we are driving and which team for there's a few reasons, and really Peter Hills, who runs the team, and myself and my father sort of sat down and chat, and we found it hard for a lot of reasons, and there was a spare seat with Tony Newman not being able to drive through an illness. And the spare seat was there, so we thought, you know, why not take the opportunity and run the car, because it's a competitive car and have him prove that, and really see how we go in Simmons Plains.
So we're jumping into a car which Patrick Watts, I think, drove before Tony Newman, and Patrick was able to really give it up to Morrison and the like.
Yeah, well, the Peugeot is a competitive car. That has proved that, and it is a lot newer than a lot of the cars in that series. Paul's got a very competitive car, as he has proved, and is a very experienced driver. We don't have quite the experience, but with the equipment being a bit better, hopefully we'll get closer up to the Vectra that John Henderson's driving and Paul Morris in the BMW.
Simmons Plains, is the track you've been to before?
No, none of the tracks this year I've been to. They're all new, so that Friday you get 2 practice sessions, and that's when I've pretty much learned the track and sort of try and dial the car in. But everywhere I've been, it has been a new experience, and it's been good because it's taught me how to learn things a lot faster without sort of trying to settle in, just really get into it and try and absorb everything in one go without wasting a great deal of time. And it has paid off, and I'm starting to get a lot more used to that. And whether it be a car or a circuit that I have to drive, it makes it a lot easier to get used to.
For summer series, for the Super Tourers, are you a bit fan of it?
We had a halfway through the year a bit of a break, but the transition between the winter and the summer series, and we've only really got a month or about a month and a half over Christmas, and then we're straight back into it, but still running the same championship. So it's a pretty flat out year, even though it's stretched out over a long period.
What was your background in motorsport?
Well, since I was about 9 or 10, I've been running go-karts, and it wasn't until this year we actually moved out of go-karts into cars, started off in Formula Ford for a few rounds, and then progressively moved up, well, quite quickly, but just through circumstance, being in the right place at the right time, and being offered a drive and a test, and everything came together quite fast. And found ourselves in the Super Touring Championship after having about 3 races under our belt. So it was a pretty fast learning curve for me, but I'm glad we did it.
Yeah, young Alan Gurr there, and of course, young guys has actually made a couple of little mistakes in his learning year with the Ford Mondeo, and sort of gone in too hot in a couple of corners. But I'll tell you what, talk about pure pace. Another young one like Dean Canto last year, strap a car on them, and doesn't matter what type of car, if it's got 4 wheels and has any halfway chance of going fast, he'll make it go fast. So
Yeah, good to see there's plenty of up-and-coming talent coming through the ranks. If you just think back a couple of years, there wasn't a whole lot of depth in Australian motorsport, and I think that the economy being a bit healthier means there's a bit more money out there for these young guys to have a go, and that's really great to see, because they are the future of the sport. And it's a bit of a pity that the weekend in the Peugeot didn't go off that well. But talking of Peugeots, let's talk about rally, somewhere where the Peugeots are very strong, of course.
Only ever.
World champions and all of that. A couple of little bits and pieces in the world of rally. Group N, the Australian Group N for next year. There's plenty of talk about changing the rules and fine-tuning the Australian Rally Championship. Of course, we get excellent coverage on Channel 10, and the only problem about it as a television event is it's a two-horse race, and that a contest, of course, is fascinating. They're so close, Possum Vaughan and Neil Bates, but then it's such a huge gap back to the rest of the field. Channel 10 have made it quite clear that they need a few more players up there fighting for the lead. So the Australian Rally Commission have been looking at ways of making the championship closer. We spoke a couple of months ago about potentially removing the active differentials from the Group A or the World Rally cars, trying to reduce the costs for the leading teams and trying to entice new teams to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
Ford Focus was one that everyone was hoping would come to Australia, maybe a factory team jump in on that one. Unfortunately, the sad state of the Australian dollar means that the Ford Australia will not be importing the Focus, and so it means we won't see that out in the forests at all. And of course, I was always talking about some of the other manufacturers, but you really do need manufacturer support, and the leading cars, apart from Subaru, they're really not sold here that much. Mitsubishi, of course, have a limited program mainly concentrating on Group N. So that's why it evolved into this question now of, let's narrow the gap. How do we make the Group N cars closer to the guys out in front? So some of the things that they were thinking about were making the turbo restrictors larger. They're currently running a 32mm restrictor. So let's open that up to 36. Would that speed them up? Well, of course it would. The only problem is that the international rules all use 32mm.
So then if they come to Rally Australia and international events they want to compete in, like Rally of Canberra, etc., sorry guys, you've got to go back, change all your programming, etc., and go back to the 32mm rule.
Yeah, you mentioned it really hit the nail on the head there about the programming. Some of the teams, and it's not only the big factory teams, Michael Thompson with the Dell Subaru team, he's an example of someone who sources his engines from ProDrive in the UK. They come as a sealed unit and he can't tinker with them in any way. So having a 36mm restrictor on these things will be a major problem. He can't remap it himself because it's all sealed. ProDrive in the UK, what percentage of their business would the Australian teams represent? Almost nothing.
And of course the development program to get the most out of an engine going from a 32 to a 36mm restrictor plate, they'd be looking to recoup that, and it's probably beyond the reach of most Australian teams to recoup that amount.
That's right, and even with the Australian teams trying to map it themselves, they really have to test an engine or two to destruction to work out the best things there. And, there's a lot of debate about this, and hopefully the Cairns and the powers that be will take notice of the debate. Hopefully it's all coming through as constructive debate rather than just harassing them. And hopefully they'll listen and they'll go back to the international standard. Many people complained years ago when Australian rallying left Group G, the glory days of Australian rallying, to go for these international rules. And I think in hindsight it was a very positive move to make. We've now got a round of the World Championship. We've got one guy on the World Championship series. And the idea that you can simply take your Australian car overseas or buy a car on the world market and run it here, there's so many benefits from having your rules synchronised to the international rules, so I really do hope that they don't go for this larger restrictor. Another one of their ideas was to keep costs down and even out the field. They weren't going to ban some of the racing fuels and the high-octane things. The rule was going to be, well, let's limit it to, I think the number is 140% of normal pump fuel. And really, you've got normal fuel, and you've got ELF racing fuel, which is 400 or 700 percent of the price of normal fuel. So, really, this 140 was just going to wipe out any other type of racing fuel apart from standard.
I think the other thing is too that we've got to remember, again, like we talk about the sealed engines, is that a lot of these engines that come from people like ProDrive and the like from overseas, they are tuned to a particular brand of fuel as well. And again, if you say, sorry, I'm not going to be able to run that fuel with that particular burn type of fuel, etc., again, you're in a situation that if you run the wrong type of fuel, the engine blows up. Sorry, it's out of warranty. Thank you. Goodbye. You just bucketed, you know, $50,000 or whatever in the trash can. So again, they've really got to start looking at, if they want to make some rule changes, if we want to get cars and be supported by manufacturers overseas, we've got to fit in with what they're doing overseas if we want them to be supported reasonably priced. Otherwise, we're out of luck.
Yeah, that's right. And we made the big investment in the years gone by to go for the international rules. We really have to keep going with that. But the costs and the other issues really don't bear thinking about, particularly if you want to be competitive when the World Championship comes to Australia. If you have to remap and relearn to drive your car with different power characteristics, it's going to make life a bit more difficult.
Mm.
And talking about the World Championship event in Perth, a couple of the stories circulating around about that one. Of course, worldwide, the World Rally Championship is starting to restrict the number of entries. In years gone by, we've had a little over 100 entries for the Telstra Rally Australia in Perth. I think this year they were limited to 80, 85. In years to come, fully expected to be 60 and less. The small teams in Australia are going for the trying to play on the big stage, and of course that I think that is good for young and upcoming drivers, get to learn what it's like playing with the big boys. It's all part of an important part of people's development. That's going to become tougher and tougher. That may be a benefit for rounds of the Asia Pacific Championship like the Rally of Canberra, but yeah, the move with Dave Richards from ProDrive and now the world rights holder for all of the Rally TV, he wants to make it more of an elite series and really polish it up into a better package for TV. And that brings us to whether Rally Australia will be in Perth for years and years to come. Of course, it will be there next year, that the calendar has been announced, but really strong rumours coming from some of the competitors that were over there in Perth that it will move to Melbourne for 2002. A lot of the emphasis putting on it now is not so much the Victorian government trying to steal it, they still are trying, but Dave Richards, as part of his TV packaging and trying to move forward, he wants it where the population base is. And unfortunately for Perth, he put on an excellent show, that means it would have to move to the East Coast, and Melbourne's the one who's top of the list there at the moment.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, that if you look at world rallying, it's also infrastructure in terms of the communications infrastructure, the television infrastructure, all those things that come together, and of course they want good sized crowds around the size of the rally stages to be visible. Maybe if they're running super stages, one that can be fully supported. And of course the important thing which Dave Richards is looking at is, as you mentioned, you know, reducing numbers, is so that more of those cars that do compete in that top level event can get some television coverage to justify their entry. And they can't do that if they've got 80 cars or 100 cars. If you've got 60, bring it down to around about 50. There is more chance you'll get some coverage, even if it's the in-car, oops, I've just put it in this great big huge ditch, or wow, what a great way to put the car on the roof shot, or uh-oh, took that corner wrong. But at least you'll get some coverage, where currently, even if you do that, quite often you don't get the coverage because there's just too many other top-line guys and you're too far down the pecking order.
Yeah, that's right. They're quite sensible plans for growing the TV presence and the marketability of the sport. I think we have to run with that. It's just a little unfortunate some of the second-tier teams will have to miss out. If you want to run in Rally Australia in the years to come, you really will have to commit to doing the entire Australian Rally Championship and get to the top of the pecking order of Australian rallying. You have to be in the top, say, 15 of the national championship to get in.
Talking about a man overseas, Michael Guest. This is what it sounds like in the car with him.
So you got 150, fast, medium, left, short. Then 50, fast, medium, right, left. 70, east, left, short. 70, fast medium left short, brake danger right, entry unseen fast K right.
Yeah, Michael Guest there and rallying off on the, I think it was Finn or someone else. Of course, the thing for him is he's lost his major naming rights sponsor, one of those terrible tobacco companies. So he's actually having to look for a new sponsor for next year. But the talk is that one of the lead drivers with that Hyundai team that he's been providing the car for him may be poached by another team, so therefore it might open up a spot for him. So his fingers crossed for Michael Guest.
That's right. That's Australia's leading international rally driver. We really do wish the best for him. It's interesting, though, that the word from Perth was that when he crashed out of Rally Australia, one of the innovations for this year's event was some large super screens in service areas. All the service crews could keep track of what was happening out in the forests. And, of course, the Hyundai team, when they saw Michael Guest stick it into the wall, I think it was at Langley Park, the whole team cheered, which is not what you expect from the guys who have to try to put it back together and keep them in the rally. There might be a bit of friction there. Well, we'll have to watch that one and be interesting to see.
Yeah, we'll see how that one works out. But moving to fuel of a different kind, and the Victorian Drag Racing Championships kicked off in Melbourne yesterday, and a combination of top flight Australian drag racing and perfect Melbourne weather gave Melbourne drag racing fans a number of exciting battles for early season championship points. A total of 11 drag racing brackets competing at Calder Park in the 2000 Victorian Drag Racing Championships. The top fuel battle for first points of the 2000-2001 season saw top qualifier Jim Reed in his Gregory's Top Fuel Team Dragster run up against Robin Kirby's Penzoil Dragster. In a close charge from the green light, both drivers battled wheel spin most of the way through the close pass, Reed setting the quickest ET at 5.447 seconds, that's 212.56 miles per hour, with a 0.494 second reaction time. Despite the hard charging challenge from his Victorian rival, who set an ET of 5.516 seconds, a time of a reaction time of 0.511 of a second, and a terminal speed of 267.77 miles per hour, the second fastest pass of the event. Melbourne driver Darren DeFilippo in the pit stop oil change Valvoline dragster staged the Santo Reposado machine, which he agreed to pilot for the meeting against New South Wales driver Steve Reed, but the pass was short-lived for the current Australian top fuel terminal speed record holder DeFilippo. The 28-year-old was forced to shut down soon after launch after a superb reaction time of 0.473 seconds, allowing Reed to power on to a strong but conservative 5.167 ET at a terminal speed of 251.67 miles per hour. The top fuel final saw Steve Reed power to the fastest pass of the event after a 0.514 second reaction time, an ET of 5.121 seconds at an impressive terminal speed of 282.22 miles per hour, taking the win from fellow Sydney sider Jim Reed, who suffered excessive wheel spin and tyre shake after launch, forcing him to abandon the pass. A reaction time of 0.485 seconds, an ET of 7.869 seconds, and 98.76 miles per hour. Boy, there's a gap there, isn't there? In the highly competitive pro stock bracket, Bruno Cugnetto won his first round eliminator with a 7.844 second, 175.37 miles per hour. It was a spectacular pass of Queensland-based Ford Probe driver John Barbagallo that had the Calder Park crowd on their feet. Despite Barbagallo's efforts to keep the powerful car within its lane, he swayed across the centre line to find himself directly behind Cugnetto by the end of the pass, wiping him out of contention. That would have been interesting to watch, wouldn't it? New South Wales driver Jason Grimer powered his Probe to a resounding semi-final win over reigning Pro Stock champion Peter Ridgway in a 7.767 second, 177.97 mile per hour pass in his Oldsmobile Cutlass. Grimer's outstanding reaction time of 0.411 of a second served him well to win a close battle despite his slightly lower ET and terminal speed. This was the second finals appearance missed by Ridgway after making it to every Pro Stock final last season. Only hair-raising moment for the meeting saw Performance Distributors Racing modified Limino dragster driver Rachel Clancy barrel roll her car at the end of her practice pass on Saturday morning, luckily escaping major injury. The same cannot be said for her dragster chassis, which was destroyed in the spectacular accident. So the dragster season for Victoria kicking off down there at Calder Park. No doubt, once again, we'll hear more about that as the season goes on.
Yeah, it's just a pity that we can't get to see some more of this exciting drag action locally here in Canberra.
Yes, what will ever become of Canberra National Dragway? Will we see it reborn or somewhere else? Hopefully, hopefully we'll get a track here some stage. You know, really, if you look at it, the amount of revenue Canberra loses by not having that dragway here, and when we come time for summer nats, again, an opportunity where it goes begging, instead we'll probably get the idiot class up and down the back streets of Braddon.
Yes, that's right. I mean, of course, the dragway, that there's more to it than the government not liking drag racing. It's tied up with the airport privatisation and some of the development that's going on there. So the government, I guess, to give them credit where it's due, is that they've stuck in an awkward position where they have to balance competing needs. But we know where we would strike the balance.
Yes, dragway for Canberra, thank you.
That's right. Okay, and sort of related to drag racing, at least in my mind, is NASCAR. NASCAR, the season is well and truly wrapped up, but now they're getting ready for next year, a couple of fine-tuning of rules and things like that. Starting off the season for NASCAR, of course, is the Speed Week at Daytona, leading up to the Daytona 500, and one of the first races of the 2001 series will be the Bud Shootout. Now, qualifying for the Daytona 500 is more complicated than the GST, and really, if you can describe it in 100 words or less exactly how you qualify, you're doing really well. But the Bud Shootout is one of those. I think that the first two places in the Bud Shootout automatically go into the 500, but it's far too complicated to work that out. In previous years, the Bud Shootout was run over just 25 laps, and it made it to be quite a frantic race trying to win that and secure your position in the 500. From next year going forward, the Bud Shootout will be a much larger onerous event. They will extend the race to run for a little bit over an hour. I think it will be about 70 laps, making it much tougher. It's really, to enter the Bud Shootout, it really is a case of entry by invitation, really limited to many of the pole winners from the previous year and some of the special names of the sport. But it really is a fast track to the start line for the Daytona 500. Also talking about qualifying for NASCAR races, in years gone by they've had a second round qualifying on the Friday afternoon or sometimes on the Saturday. Most of the field is taken up on the first round qualifying, which is held on Fridays. But what they found is that the second round qualifying, nothing was really happening. There were no developments. People were already using their provisionals and other ways to get on the grid. So the second round qualifying was pretty much a waste of time. So they've finally seen the light on that. They're going to scrap it and allow all teams a bit more time on the track to fine-tune their race setup to have a more interesting and exciting race on the Sunday. So that's probably a step in the right direction. Also, in the world of NASCAR, we've spoken previously about Bill France, the boss of NASCAR. NASCAR really is the France family. It's not a corporation as such, or hasn't been in the past. And Bill France, unfortunately, has been quite ill with cancer. He has remained hands-on as much as he could, but he had appointed Mike Helton as an operational officer. Bill France has now promoted Mike Helton into the full CEO and taking the whole role of running NASCAR. So it's sad to see old Bill having to let go a little bit more. He will still be involved, of course, on a board of directors to help run and direct the future of NASCAR. Some interesting comments about, you know, previously the board meetings were basically Bill and some other members of the France family running into each other in the hallway and now chatting about an issue. It really was a closely held organisation, becoming a little bit more corporate-like perhaps. And why that is interesting, that it's a family-run business in some respects, it is now worth $2.8 billion US dollars in TV rights. So that's not bad for a little family business.
Mm. Yeah, of course, the other major...
In the United States, I had the opportunity to meet one of the characters of NASCAR racing, Darrell Waltrip, as he was about to make his final start at the Talladega Super Speedway.
The thing I remember the most about them was I led. First time I'd ever been to a track like this. Well, I take that back. I had been to Daytona. in a sportsman race. It was the first time I'd been to a Winston Cup race in 1972, and I had a pretty good car. But I led a few laps in that race and actually had a very legitimate chance at winning. That was based on a tire controversy that was going on at the time. Goodyear had come here with a new treaded tire. They used to run the, or they still do, the slick tire. This was the only place where we ran the slick tire. Everywhere else they run the treaded tire. And so they had come here and done some testing, and they determined that they would run the treaded tire here like they ran everywhere else. Well, lo and behold, they get in the race, and the speeds go up, and the tires are flying all to pieces. Well, when I bought my car from Holman and Moody, the last place it had raced was here. And so when I bought it, I got, I think I got 12 or 16 tires with it, which happened to be Talladega tires. So that had a lot to do with me running here the first time, because I had the tires and the car had been raced here before. And so, you know, I figured Talladega was a good place to start off. Well, lo and behold, we get in the race. And all the fast guys, Richard, Buddy, Cale, Bobby, Donnie, everybody's having tire trouble. Their tires are flying apart. And everybody is running around looking for the old slick tires like I had. The ironic part about that was my crew chief was Jake Elder. Jake was livid. He said, "You can't win. I had no tools. I had a car, and I had a few tools and a few spare parts that I'd gotten with the car, and that's all I had. I'd gone to Western Auto and bought my tools, my jack stands, that cheap stuff like you use in your home garage." So my crew chief's not happy at all, and because he's a winning crew chief. He's been around a long time. And he said, "Man, you can't do any good down here like this. You got the wrong tires. Your car's no good. You're wasting your time." He left me here on Saturday afternoon in happy hour and went back to the hotel. He was so disgusted. Well, we get in the race, and everybody's having tire trouble, except the guys that have the old tires, like myself, and another guy named James Hilton, who happened to have all old tires because he couldn't afford new ones. And lo and behold, I'm going along, and all of a sudden, holy cow, I just passed Richard Petty. Man, I just passed David Pearson. I'm passing all these fast cars. I didn't know there was a tire problem, and you know, our communication wasn't that good at the time. I didn't know there was a tire problem. Then the next thing I thought of was, I have this crew chief named Jake Elder, who is notorious for cheating. Well, we raced restrictor plates then, too. I said, "Uh-oh, I know what's happened. He's left the plate. We've got the wrong plate on this car, or maybe we don't even have a plate on this car, and I'm going to get in big trouble my first race out." That's all I could think about was I was cheating. But as the day wore on, and something happened to my car, the engine in my car, and I fell out of the race after leading a good bit. And I got in the garage, and then I found out, well, the tires were the problem, and we wasn't cheating. And I actually ended up making more money that day selling my tires than I did in the race itself. So I sold all my tires to the teams that were having tire trouble, and I ended up making more money selling used tires than I did what I won in the purse. So that was my introduction into Winston Cup racing, big-time auto racing. It was right here, and it was it was one of those weekends that was just full of things happening, you know, that I was not even aware of or prepared for. But bottom line was, I made the race, I led the race, and I actually had a chance to win the first race I'd ever been to. And that was just about as much encouragement as I needed right there to know that, hey man, this is going to be good. This is going to be fun.
News this week, of course, is the new head of the CART set up, where they've taken on a television executive, I believe, with a background in motorsport over the years, to take over from Bobby Rahal, of course, who's now gone to take charge of Jag. And I tell you what, reading the British Autosport magazine, sounds like he's about to put the cleaners through the Jaguar team over there, and they've already appointed a new American chief engineer for the team, a fellow who was involved with Formula One previously. He'd stepped away for a number of years and has returned. I'm sure I'll dig his name out a little bit later on, but the new guy who heads up CART, I think that's going to be something quite interesting.
Yeah, the guy is Joseph Heitzler, and as you said, he's got a background in really running TV type of issues. CART, of course, is publicly owned, so it these things become quite important. It's listed on the New York Stock Exchange. And his thoughts are that the championship needs to be more professionally driven, evolving from what is now an entrepreneurial spirit, but really needs to be that step further to become a little bit more business-like. Heitzler, has previously been the president and CEO of National Mobile Television Production since 1998, and he's also worked for CBS Sports and Forum Sports Entertainment, so his background really is on the broadcast side of things, and that's somewhere where CART really do need to lift their game, particularly in the US. We've spoken many times before about the struggle that CART have. They don't have enough born and bred US drivers, which would really help them with promoting it for US TV. But I'm sure that the new CEO there will be putting in some new things, trying to make it more of a television happy type of race series. And it's interesting that he says that it needs to be more professionally driven. I was particularly impressed at the way they put together their show when they popped into Toronto each year. It really is a professional race meeting, and I don't know how you could top it. Maybe it is.
I concern how few U.S. drivers are in champ cars. Well, I'm concerned that more U.S. drivers aren't being considered. It may sound cruel, but racing has never been one for affirmative action. You know, just because you're an American doesn't mean that gives you some inalienable right to drive a champ car. What gives you that right is to prove that you're the best, or that you have the greatest potential, or that you have great talent. And there are Americans who have proven that they can compete with anybody from around the world, and they're doing that today in not just champ car, but lights and Atlantic. There are young Americans over in Europe showing that they can compete against whoever may be. And frankly, that's what American drivers have to do. They have to prove their mettle against whoever, because the fact of the matter is that when you have a racing team, your sponsors expect you to win. And you have an obligation to do that. And so you have to have the best person in that car driving that you can in order to achieve that. As I said, that's not exclusive of Americans. Frankly, there's been a lot of Australians that have featured internationally, or New Zealanders that have featured internationally over the years. I think talent is talent. It doesn't really matter where it comes from. It rises to the top. And we just have to make sure that, for example, the stronger we make Atlantic, the stronger we make Light, the better able the teams that are in champ car will be able to judge that talent and therefore choose. And if the tougher the educational system, so to speak, for Americans, then more of them will get to the top. It's that simple. I'm a neophyte to Formula One. But I guess if I were to say anything, it's clear that when all else is said and done, when the lights go off or the flag drops here, it's a race. It's a race of the race of the race. There certainly is a lot more, maybe not relative to this race, but on average a lot more hype surrounding a Formula One event. You know, I think in CART, the race is the show. From outside looking in Formula One, I'm not sure. I think the show is the show. You know, I mean, it's there's an awful lot of extracurricular stuff going on that contributes to the excitement. So they're really two very different approaches, and but they're both very they both are obviously successful, and in each case it works, and. You know, that's why I think they can both survive, because they are very, very different from one another.
Well, influencing the driver makeup and making it more palatable to the US viewers.
Mm. Actually, interesting enough, talking about, you know, sort of the overseas emphasis, over in the UK, the Rockingham Motor Speedway, which is going to be the UK's first kart circuit, that track is continuing to take shape. It's a 1.5-mile track, and it'll play host to the CART Championship in September 2001, and it's what they call a uniquely shaped square oval. Facilities around the circuit are also taking shape, despite awful weather the UK has been suffering recently, and the area around the Corby Base track has experienced flooding over the past few weeks, like most of the UK. I think somebody's got to have the pumps manned there. But interesting enough, to tell you how prepared the Brits are getting for that that first kart race in September 2001, a recent issue of one of the British motorsport magazines I received had the ad saying, buy your tickets now, the 1-800 number in the UK, the whole box and dice, yeah, get your seats now. So they're anticipating, I think, that it will be very, very big, and I'd say that's going to be quite an event for the Brits. I think it might make them sit up and take notice.
That will be interesting because, I mean, England really is Formula One territory. So this is the kart championship taking on Formula One right in its own backyard. So that will be interesting, particularly with the British race fans brought up on sports cars, Formula One, and the British Touring Car Championship. They're going to be fairly set in their ways of what they see as a good race. It'll be interesting to see what they think of an oval, even if it's square.
Yeah. Anyhow, just going back to those changes at Jaguar that we mentioned a little bit earlier on, American Formula One engineer Steve Nichols has been named as the new technical director of Jaguar Racing. He's replaced Gary Anderson, who is now expected to go to the United States to work in kart, the rumour there being potentially with Roberto Moreno at Patrick Racing. In addition to Anderson, several other top Jaguar engineers are to be replaced, including chief engineer Andy LeFleming and design engineer Dave Rendell. So the old story goes on. The new broom comes in and some major shake-ups over at Jaguar. And the word is that they're trying to clear away a lot of the old Stewart Grand Prix structures so the team can become truly a Jaguar team rather than the old Stewart team in different clothing. Great quote, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought that the idea of Ford buying the Stewart team was that there was something good there, that Stewart had some success and they wanted to build on that.
It makes you wonder, and last year they had an abysmal year, so you know, it's the same guys. What happened? Was there too much interference from top Ford management coming in to the way that Jackie Stewart used to run? Because we know Paul Stewart has been off with cancer and has been undergoing a lot of treatment there. Obviously that's probably distracted Jackie, but he's moved back a step from the type of management role he had in the past. You know, is there more to the story than meets the eye?
How hands-on was Jackie Stewart in the running of the team?
Yeah, apparently he had a fair bit of influence in terms of what went on.
Okay. Well, still on Formula One, but now they're starting to talk about traction control. And it's something that, of course, was in Formula One many years ago, and they had to step up pretty quickly to try to outlaw it. And now they're starting to talk about, well, if you can't beat them, join them. That there's been a lot of rumours and suggestions and finger pointing that certain teams have been able to get around the controls on traction control by hiding the programming as part of their other electronic engine management systems. And so, yeah, deciding now that we should seriously look at, let's put it back in, but with some strict controls on it, so you don't have to hide it to get the basic functionality. You can have your basic functionality. And we may see it as soon as the Spanish Grand Prix next year. We might see it from Melbourne, the start of the year, because they still have to develop what the rules will be, making sure that it's something that can be adequately policed and controlled, we'll take it from there.
Yeah,
so that will be very interesting to watch, particularly the idea of groove tyres and things like that, trying to open up the racing series, trying to make it more of the driver's skill. So here's a step in the other direction, allowing some more traction control and electronic management systems there to try to help control the car rather than the driver themselves.
Yeah, and we'll see how that goes, because I think that's going to prove one of the interesting sides of...
Are you talking to me?
One. Anyhow, the man down in Simmons Plains today who has tied up the Independence Championship for the BOC Gases is the man in the Leatherman Racing Alfa Romeo, David Auger. David, congratulations on tying up that Independence Championship.
Thank you very much. It was good to do it with a bit of time up our sleeve too.
Of course, for you, with your major sponsor Leatherman coming on this year, probably a good way to show them that the investment was good.
Yes, I think they'll be happy. I haven't spoken to anyone from Leatherman yet, but we've certainly done the best we could to repay them, and everybody's wrapped here as well.
Now, your results today, how did you place in today's two races?
We were fifth in both races and second independent in both races. We took the race meeting as to make sure we tied the championship up. we moved back up into third place overall in the Drivers' Championship, so that's sort of our next aim, to stay third.
Mm. And the way it is now, that you basically, because your car does have, your car and your team have got great reliability, and that's something you can really bank on.
Well, you never bank on it, but that's what we've got to work hard, make sure we don't lose the plot for the next four races, and if we can keep that reliability, maybe we can keep that third place, so that's the next aim.
Mm. Now, basically, I'd say you've probably got this Alfa Romeo working as hard as it's ever worked. Is there much more you can really eke out of it in terms of speed?
There's probably not much more we can do unless we, you know, spend a lot of money on it, and as far as update it with the latest spec engine. That's not something we're going to do, because the kilometres that they do drops dramatically.
Mm. And, of course, then sort of a case of diminishing returns in terms of your investment.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So, in terms of now, you go to the next round at Wakefield Park on the Australia Long Weekend. What's your plans there?
Well, our plans are now to, we don't have to be quite so conservative, which we have been in the last two races. We can now go and race, and we'll try and secure that third place in the Drivers' Championship. The Independence Cup's now out of the way, so we don't have to think about that.
Mm.
And we'll just see how we go.
All right. So, a bit of a break now for you guys on the team and yourself between now and then?
Yeah, well, when we get back, the car will be back on Thursday, so we'll start next week and get it ready, and we've just got a little bit of work to do on the engine, and then we'll have a little break, which will be nice. We've been pretty busy in the last 2 months.
Mm, a fairly busy race schedule. In terms of the Wakefield Park circuit, is it a circuit that suits the Alfa Romeo, or is it one that you find doesn't suit it so well?
Not too bad. We had a little bit of trouble with the brakes there, but we found out what the problem was. It was okay in race one, but we had a problem in race two. We've solved that problem, so we're looking forward to going back. And of course, the last round, Oran Park, which we really do well at. So, you know, we just hope for the best.
Yep. Well, David, once again, congratulations on tying up the Independence Championship and the BAC Gases Championship. Wish you and the guys on the team a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, and we'll catch up with you, no doubt, at Wakefield Park for the first round of the 2001 part of the championship.
Yeah, thanks for that, and Merry Christmas to all the listeners. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, David Auger.
Okay.
Yep, great guy. Yeah, David's one of those guys, you've got to get him to talk, but he's always happy to talk to you when you're actually at the track. Yeah, but good guy. One of those people that's good to see him, actually. He's been working at the championship for years. That car, I think, as people may remember, was start off as a Stephen Richards car. It got wiped out in about the second race that he had it. You know, a little bit of a contretemps with Bob Tweedy, who used to be around those days. Team reshelled it, rebuilt it, and they've just been working on it slowly. And he's actually had it circulating at circuits in recent times faster than Stephen Richards had it going around. It's just a matter of just the progression of development over time. So, just as you know, the guys in the Super Touring Championship, they are trying. Just sometimes, okay, he's got to try and get that guy in front.
That's right, and I'm quite looking forward to the Australia Day long weekend and popping up to Wakefield Park, where I'm sure they'll put on an excellent show again.
Because the interesting thing that we made a brief mention of last weekend, where we actually tried to get hold of Paul Pickett earlier on, is the Wakefield 500 for the Daewoos. They're running a 500-kilometre mini enduro. I think in a day with 500 kilometres you have to describe as a enduro rather than a mini enduro. But the idea is it's up to a maximum of 3 drivers per car. I think it's $9,000-odd, which buys you the whole package. You've got to provide your own pit crew and so on, which means, you know, if you've got some mates who can change tyres and pump in fuel, you're doing okay. But a great idea. They're going to have all the engines dynoed, so they're all within 1 to 2 horsepower of each other before the event, and everything's going to be done over all the brakes and everything. So basically, you roll up, you qualify, etc. If you haven't got a competition license currently, they can actually get you to the stage where you can compete in the event with a couple of driver training sessions and so on beforehand. Should be fun. Unfortunately, I just don't have the money to hand.
Yeah, that's right. It's the only thing stopping a lot of us very enthusiastic racers, and that's the finances. But, I saw that ad last week as well, and I thought, ooh, that would be interesting.
Mm.
If only we could $9,000 fell out of the sky for us, we'd be in there like a shot, because I think that's a great concept. I wonder if there's any rules or regulations stopping you inviting Neil Bates along for the weekend to be one of those drivers. You can stick it on pole, and he can do his stint and get you out in front, and then you just jump in and see what you can do.
Yeah, well, the storyline is that apparently anybody can drive. It's being done as a very much a fun thing. There are prizes for fastest lap each hour of the race. So if you've got a hot shoe guy who can get in and do that for you, you could probably recover your investment. And of course, there's prizes for winning as well. So I think actually that the prize for winning is double the amount that you've paid for the entry. So if you also do the fastest lap, you can actually come out in front. I'm going to have to go and talk to Neil over the week. And then we're doing the Australian Long Weekend.
Yeah, if there's any sponsors out there, give us a call.
Yeah, we can give you the station number for sure. But no, actually, I'd say it's going to be quite a fun thing. And of course, being close to home, it's actually going to be quite a big weekend with that day we race, the Super Tourers, the Future Tourers, and apparently they've got a few other major categories planned to attend that. And a few weeks later, we'll be back with the Konica Series for the V8 Junior Series, Lights, whatever they want to call it this year, next year, so that'll be long as well.
Yeah, I think Wakefield Park really do have a good business plan that's making some progress there. So it'll be great that the people in the ACT will have a racetrack nearby, just up the road, and Wakefield are going to bring us the type of racing that we've always wanted to see.
And back to Formula One, they've been testing over in Jerez over the last week, and just going through a few quick bits and pieces that came from that. Juan Pablo Montoya is encouraged by how well he's adapted on his return to Formula One. The Colombian Champ Car race completed 3 days of testing with the Williams BMW team at Jerez. He set the second fastest time on Wednesday's wet session and finished 11th and 12th overall in the dry on Tuesday and Thursday respectively. It was his first run in an F1 car since 1998. He said, the 3 days at Jerez have certainly exceeded my expectations. I didn't expect to be on the pace right from the beginning. I'm obviously delighted on my return to Formula One. In other news there, BR Honda new recruit Olivia Panis was on top of the timesheet at Jerez on Thursday afternoon, with Ferrari of Rubens Barrichello second quickest, with David Coulthard and the McLaren third. The Bridgestone shot cars dominated the session, holding the top 8 spots. Ralf Schumacher's Williams BMW was the fastest of the cars running on Michelin tyres, because that's the new thing, the Michelin tyres that have come in. Panis meanwhile, says he believes his BR Honda can be developed into a car to challenge the McLaren-Ferrari domination of Formula 1. The car's got a good baseline to build on, he said. I know exactly what a good car is after testing for McLaren this year. This car can be a challenge to McLaren. He's hopeful, isn't he?
Very bold comments, aren't they?
Yes, obviously having a full-time drive does wonders for the nerves. The other item there, of course, Citroën is coming to the World Rally Championship next year. They are due to have a launch in the very near future of their World Rally Championship contender, and they've actually built new premises near Versailles in France to support their World Rally Championship entry. So, yeah, we've got Peugeot, Citroën, Hyundai, Mitsubishi, Subaru. It's getting quite big there, isn't it? It's growing.
Yeah, that's right. And wouldn't be great if some of these teams came to the Australian Championship. But still on the World Rally Championship, there was some talk in the last couple of weeks about the Rally of Great Britain and moving to a date, perhaps in September, to get away from England's and Wales' miserable weather for the month of November. There's a lot of history and tradition about the Rally of Great Britain, and really it is about the snow and miserable weather and the mud and all of that type of stuff, but it doesn't make it particularly spectator-friendly, of course. Well, it's been announced this week that, it's still in November, they won't be changing dates, but the Acropolis Rally in Greece and the Cyprus Rally have switched dates. And the Safari Rally in Kenya has been put back into the middle of July, so they keep juggling the calendar there. And for Australian Rally fans, Rally Australia will be on from the 1st to the 4th of November. Yes, similar to the traditional date. So you can start planning a trip to Perth for that one.
Now, people may have heard talk during the recent times about the fact that Garth Tander was the man in the hot seat for the final laps at Bathurst. And people sort of have said, well, why? What were they talking about? And he's saying he's driving his backside off. Well, The trick was that at Bathurst, the team had been experimenting with a one-sided exhaust system, where the exhaust exits out under the passenger side of the car. Their endurance specification setup has a dual exhaust system, so it actually has two mufflers, one under the passenger side floor, one under where the driver's side floor and seat is, and exits out both sides of the car. Apparently, you know, it has to do with just how the car works for endurance specification. The problem was that since they hadn't run it in that specification for some time, it didn't have the heat insulation and heat shields and other bits and pieces in the car that normally would be there. Also, Jason Garth has his seat sitting literally on the floor of the car, and the heat was being transmitted from the muffler under the driver's side floor up through the seat into his backside, so he ended up with second degree burns. Not a good way to drive.
No, it's lucky he won, and that way the celebrations that night would have worked as a bit of an anaesthetic. It would only be Wednesday or Thursday that he'd actually come to and go, oh, that hurts.
Yeah, I think it'd be one of those things. I know there's a few occasions over the years where drivers have been burnt. I know Nigel Mansell, he's another one who got burnt by spilt fuel down his back, and I think he had a radiator hose or something from a turbocharger let go at one stage. I know there's been a number of Formula 1 drivers and drivers in different categories. I know particularly Le Mans category drivers are ones who a number of times have driven with cars where they've had exhaust fumes into the cockpit, you know, heat from turbochargers when they run the turbocharged cars, etc. And it just proves the fact that there is a certain degree of stamina and endurance required of motor racing other than just sitting there steering the wheel.
That's right, and of course that's why these young and upcoming drivers were at the Australian Institute of Sport the other week. There is a physical side to the sport, even though many people sort of scoff at that idea. It definitely is physical. Okay, it's not running a marathon, but the physical and mental stamina really is required, and that goes to show that these things really are there.
Mm. And it always makes you sort of wonder, you know, sort of, they talk about different things. Like the other week, they had the piece of news about one of the top drag racer fellows, you know, sort of retiring because basically the G-forces had been detaching the retinas in his eyes, so basically he has to give up the drag racing because otherwise he'd go blind. The G-forces and so on that involve drag racers, Formula 1 drivers, the physical exertion, the heat, etc. People got to remember, driving in a three-layer Nomex race suit with a fairly hefty helmet, the forces that go on, concentration driving, there's a fair bit to it, and people often don't see that side of it.
Yeah, that's right, and yeah, that's why people train so hard. And of course, it really often comes down to a bit of a selfishness thing as well, with the training. We need to get another 2 or 3 kilos out of the car, so you have to sweat it off. And these guys train pretty hard.
Mm. And yeah, it's one of those things that I think probably they've actually done the things with the heart monitors and heart pace and so on with cars and drivers, etc. And it is interesting just to see the strain that goes on. I remember some years ago they actually had one of those with a guy who was running at Le Mans, and they had the, you know, like the lead up to the start, and the heart pace was fairly down, and sort of the times, just the 30-second board, etc., the old heart rate went up, because they do the flying start with Le Mans, roll and start, and of course the further around the lap he got, the higher the heart rate got, and actually as he crossed the line, sort of it peaked, and for the first couple of laps it sort of stayed up there, then it settled down. And there's a couple of times where it spiked where, you know, people spun out in front or similar. And then it sort of starts to creep up again in the time where he's leading up to his pit stop. Because again, he was trying to get position on the track, get as much time over other competitors, and was actually driving harder, but also anticipating what he had to do when it came time for the pit stop, where he had to, you know, unbuckle, jump out, help the other guy get in, give him a quick briefing about what was going on and the like. And again, it sort of it spiked coming into the pit lane. Of course, then as he actually got to go out of the car, of course they lost telemetry as he sort of, you know, unplugged and jumped out, and the new guy came in, his was off the clock. And again, you know, first couple of laps was up there again, and it settled down and again, but it's just interesting to see the fact that they've got that information available, and to where it goes from there. So, you know, there is more to motorsport than just sitting in the car and steering, as they say. If you play with PlayStation, it doesn't really show you what it's like.
Not quite. And maybe that's the reason that the GMC 400 here in Canberra is run when it's so awful cold. We've often seen at the Adelaide 500 race that some of these drivers are getting out of the car and they're just wrecked. And that's where some of the guys who take the fitness side of things particularly seriously, and Tony Longhurst, he often does triathlon events just in his spare time as a hobby, they really do come to the fore whereas I think it was some of our guests from overseas, people from England and perhaps New Zealand, they've often done it tough. Maybe, of course, with the weather conditions and everything like that, they don't normally have to face the extreme heat that Adelaide seems to put on quite often.
Actually, that's one of the things I'm looking forward to down at the American Le Mans Series race of 1,000 years down in Adelaide over Christmas New Year, over the New Year period, is the fact that Adelaide, that time of year, is usually high 30s, low 40s, and it's going to be interesting to see around that Grand Prix circuit, which, because of the concrete walls all around, the air movement in there is usually fairly static. What sort of temperatures are going to be getting in those cars? I reckon that some of the teams are coming with two drivers in their lineup. I'm wondering if maybe the third driver might get drafted in after they've done a couple of the test sessions and qualifying sessions and find that it's just taking too much out of the driver and he doesn't have time to rejuvenate and refresh himself before he's going in for the next session.
So why are you looking forward to that? Are you taking a helmet?
A race suit, the helmet, the gloves. So I don't unfortunately have an American Le Mans Series International license. Damn.
That could be a problem.
That could be a problem. But then again, yeah, they might confuse me with somebody else, but I don't think so somehow. But I think what it might mean is we'll see a couple of other drivers who aren't coming out or weren't initially proposed to come out. I think we might see them sort of out there and keeping an eye on things, or we might see other drivers drafting in at the last minute, and that could be quite interesting.
And of course they'll try some of those the suits with the water chilling that goes throughout, all of these things trying to keep people cool and performing at their peak for long periods of time in pretty tough conditions.
Well, next week it's the 17th of December, so we'll probably have a bit of a, I think we normally have a bit of a look back on the year that was in the next couple of shows. We'll probably try and get hold of Phil Bragan. No doubt he's flying between Simmons Plains back to Melbourne to get the next issue of Motorsport News out of the way, because he also does the commentary for the BSC Gases Championship. Then the following week, 24th is Christmas Eve, so I don't know if we'll be here. So next week might be our last show. I'll have to check with Craig how we normally play in this sort of situation. And of course the 31st, which is the week after that, is of course the American Le Mans Series event, and no doubt we'll be crossing live to Adelaide, because at that time the race will be underway, and we might actually kick off at a reasonable time for that one. And then we're back into the 2001. Heavens above. Frightening, isn't it?
It won't be much of a break.
It won't be much of a break for some of us, that's for sure.
A couple of weeks ago, we thought season's over. NASCAR and CART and Formula One were wrapping up. But it really has astounded me just how far into the off-season that the season's actually continued. There's still been plenty of things going on.
Yep. Next week, what we'll probably do is probably say, look back on the year that was, look ahead maybe to some things coming for 2001. We might make a few suggestions for those last-minute Christmas gifts for motorsport fans, and we might have a ring around, actually. We might ring around a few drivers and other people and see what they'd like to see stuffed in a stocking under their tree, other than their girlfriend or wife. But we'll see what else people would like to see, and maybe come up with a few Christmas gift suggestion ideas for people as well. And no doubt we'll probably talk to Duncan at Checkered Flag Bookshop for that one as well.
Yes, that's right. He's always got some amazing motorsport books and magazines there that any motorsport fan would love to have under the tree. So, yeah, keep him in mind in your shopping trials.
And yeah, that's all from us for this week on Inside Motorsport. We've run a little bit over time, but then we're the guys from next hour. Otherwise, we'll now cross over to the BBC World Service. For this week, for Inside Motorsport, this is Colin Ford and Peter Norton. Thank you very much, Peter, for coming and joining us this week. Craig Revell, of course, taking it easy this week. He'll be back with us next week. Thank you for listening.
Inside Motorsport is produced by Thunder Media in the studios of Triple SFM Canberra via Comrade Sat, with the support of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia.
Made a huge international impact because they were shown on television around the world.